controlled by Modi, who is a Trump mold person, leader, authoritarian, pretty much racist. She's under some legal attacks in her own country, and I thought the UK Pen were actually making a statement bringing her up. She had a very controversial address, and we'll get to that at the end of this hour. Gonna kick it. No fresh Imani Bazell. No fresh. She's on my mind. No fresh Mumia Abu Jamal. In lieu of that, I'm gonna play something from a group called Pushback, and they have a podcast that's relatively new called Black History Year. And I'm only gonna play the intro to it because I haven't had time to go through it, and maybe they start out with sort of a kind of a general topic. Amy Goodman's got a great commentary. I thought she would do something on the death penalty since we've had a firing squad execution of an admitted double murderer, but still, how barbaric is that? Greg Palaszczuk, I'm going to play a section of that. I played something from him. He did get back with his usual election crimes bulletin, and he's running the numbers about election suppression, and he says that's how it happened. It wasn't just disaffection by many people who sat out. There was also a large number who were eliminated from the voting rolls. Pretty controversial stuff. And then Phyllis Bemis, also for International Women's Day, I guess, whenever there's a fresh Phyllis Bemis statement. It's pretty international, but isn't it the case that the Israel-Palestine is really a national issue since the U.S. is still underwriting it? And it, when people said, could it get worse? Yeah, well, yeah, it has, is my opinion. All right, but here's just the intro to this long, hour-long podcast called Black History Year that focuses on the death penalty. I'm not going to play the whole thing, but you can check it out if you like.
So we're talking about mass social transformation through revolution? Is that what we're thinking about here when we think about abolition?
That's the way I think about it. During Trump's first term, he executed more federal death row inmates than 10 previous presidents combined. Now that he's back in the Oval Office, promising ICE raids, wiping out entire sections of the Constitution, and insisting on public displays of lethal force, many are asking what fresh horrors 2025 has in store, because apparently he was just getting warmed up. This time around, Trump has proposed televised lynchings and executions for offenses so minimal, you might blink twice just hearing it. I'm Darren from Push Block, and you're listening to Black History Year. We have to be clear. This country's relationship with the death penalty is drenched in blood. And in the hands of a newly re-elected president, one who once demanded capital punishment for the then wrongfully accused Central Park Five, this power feels surreal and dangerous. So how do we even get here? How do we reach a point where a president could so casually weaponize the death penalty, pointing it like a toy gun? How can he still use it as a threat against dissent? And how does U.S. history, the same one that cheered on lynch mobs and strung up innocent men, still enable this unchecked authority to persist today? Our guest, William C. Anderson, is exactly the voice we need to navigate this important conversation. He's an activist and writer whose co-authored book with Zoe Samudzi, As Black as Resistance, was described by renowned prison abolitionist Miriam Kaba as a searing indictment of the U.S. settler colonial project. His follow-up, The Nation on No Map, Black Anarchism and Abolition, only sharpened that critique, holding this country's feet to the fire. And he's not backing down today either. In a candid conversation about race.
Okay, that's pretty unorthodox to just play the intro, but I thought that was crafted so well. And this guy's book, I like, The Nation on No Map. Wonder what that's about. And again, that's Black History Year podcast from a group called Pushback, which is like a Facebook push group that I just got aware of just today. So next thing is Amy Goodman's commentary, if we go to script, and I guess we will. Sorry, I'm stretching and reaching and mouse not fail me now. Okay. Uh-oh. Well, I do have a problem, which is that the computer has not recognized my flash drive. So we'll go to plan B, I guess. Oh, here it is. Okay, well, so much for Windows telling me that the drive didn't load right, because it has. And let's go right to Amy Goodman's commentary. Got to endure some of clips from the 100 minutes of POTUS's unscheduled trip. Well, it wasn't a State of the Union because, of course, here we go. Listen to this.
Courts just say no to Trump's authoritarian power grabs. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. At his speech before the joint session of Congress Tuesday night, President Donald Trump told many lies as he bragged,
"We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or 8 years, and we are just getting started."
Federal courts are also just getting started as scores of lawsuits challenging Trump's executive orders proceed. Several key decisions have halted or delayed some of Trump's attempts to demolish much of the U.S. government, aided by his largest campaign donor, the world's richest man, Elon Musk, and by Vice President J.D. Vance, who argues court orders are optional. They're not. The Republican-controlled Congress has completely ceded its role in the system of checks and balances, so the fights are taking place at protests in the streets and in federal courts across the country. One key sector currently under threat is medical research. The United States has long been regarded as the world's leader in cutting-edge medical research and innovation. Many of the advances that billions of people rely on around the world come from countless labs in this country. On February 7th, Trump stripped down National Institutes of Health, the NIH, issued a memo changing the allowed amount for laboratory overhead to 15%, gutting university research. Overhead, or indirect costs, cover things like rent and administrative staff, which allow researchers to conduct their life-saving work. Arbitrarily cutting those pre-approved rates sent shockwaves through the research community and provoked several lawsuits. On Wednesday, a federal judge in Massachusetts overruled the NIH, compelling the original overhead payments to resume, citing the, quote, risk to human life as research and clinical trials are suspended, unquote. This case will be appealed and will likely end up in the Supreme Court, where 6 of the 9 justices are Republican appointees, 3 of them appointed by Trump himself. While he might consider the Supreme Court to be in his pocket, Trump got a surprise on Wednesday when, in a 5-4 decision, the court ruled on another case against Trump. This case, State Department versus AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, AVAC, deals with the abrupt freezing of all U.S. foreign aid described initially as a 90-day pause and the attempted dissolving of USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. AVAC sued, with the help of Public Citizen Litigation Group, attorney Nicholas Sansone explained the case on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
After the judge entered this temporary restraining order requiring the executive branch to lift the foreign assistance freeze, the executive took no steps toward compliance, restoring none of the funding, renewing access to no grant money, and restarting none of the projects upon which communities worldwide depend. So after nearly 2 weeks of noncompliance, the court entered an order requiring the government to take specific steps towards complying.
White House lawyers asked the Supreme Court to overturn that court order, and in an unsigned one-paragraph order supported by the three liberal justices and by Chief Justice John Roberts and Trump appointee Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the request was denied. The Trump administration must now release about $2 billion in aid, a fraction of the more than $40 billion the agency disperses annually. Nicholas Enrich, acting assistant administrator for global health at USAID, wrote a memo obtained by the New York Times which detailed likely impacts of the foreign aid funding freeze, among them up to 18 million cases of malaria, a 30% increase in tuberculosis globally, 28,000 cases of Ebola, and 200,000 paralytic polio cases a year over the next decade. After the memo's publication, Enrich was placed on administrative leave. Mitchell Warren, executive director of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, the lead plaintiff in the case, speaking on Democracy Now!, described the value of PEPFAR, the U.S.-funded AIDS treatment program for people in Africa living with HIV, launched by President George W. Bush with bipartisan support.
PEPFAR, over 20 years, has helped to save, get 20 million people on antiretroviral therapy that saves lives and prevents infections. Millions of people's lives have been saved. And, you know, remember, George Bush started this with bipartisan support because people were dying, and PEPFAR has ensured that people are living and economies are growing, and the United States benefits from that.
Warren added,
PEPFAR is the most data-driven, is the most evidence-based intervention we've seen, honestly, in the history of global health. And I hope that Democrats and Republicans, including Marco Rubio, it's important to note that Secretary of State Rubio, when he was Senator Rubio, was one of PEPFAR's biggest supporters. So we need to remind people what they said, what they believed, and to stop this willful disregard of congressional authority and of science.
The case goes back to the district court, where attorney Nicholas Sansone hopes to prevail. Described here are just two cases, among at least 105 federal lawsuits challenging Trump's abuse of executive power. In parallel, massive grassroots organizing is happening, mobilizing in defense of federal workers, immigrants, trans rights, and more. The opposition to Trump's second term, to use his own words, is just getting started. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. Well, this gives me the opportunity to go after the Cheney-Bush administration because we're hearing a lot of plaudits for the war crime in retirement in Texas. Can't go anywhere else in the world, probably doesn't want to. 6 months before the PEPFAR initiative happened, Cheney was at an international meeting in, I forget where it was. There's a Guardian article from 2008 on this. I was trying to get the title of the article, but I'll have to try another method of doing that. Anyway, torpedoing a generic drugs okay for lesser developed countries. The negotiation had already gone into its later stages, and at the last minute, Cheney was there to torpedo it on behalf of Big Pharma and the U.S. economy, I guess he would say. So the upshot of this is PEPFAR was great, but it could have been much greater if it had been gone forward with generic drugs. So, yeah. Unreported detail that I keep trying to get into the mix. I've been sending it to Amy for a while. So I guess we're going with Phyllis Bennis first. Like I said, I'm going to end with the International Women's Day piece that will be and Arundhati Roy. I've never read one of her novels. I want to. I haven't read a novel in a long time. Short form is the thing that happens. You read an essay online. Brian Edwards Tiekert caught up with her on Thursday. He had just done an interview about what's going on in Syria right now. There seems to be the bloodletting that was expected after the jihadists that the U.S. supported. Plague on both their houses? I don't know. The Management of Savagery book by Max Blumenthal, which I only read part of. I want to finish that someday. He was shaken down on his way back from Central America in the middle of the night traveling with his wife and child. So maybe I'm going to get something from that. So here's another producer that I go to a lot, Brian Edwards Tiekert, with the great Phyllis Bennis. I think he does the great introduction, so I'll turn it over to them. And part of Greg Palast's Election Crimes Bulletin, it's a fundraising episode. I hope there aren't any in this particular segment, but you can always change the name they're pitching for and make it WEFT and support us. Not that I dissuade you from supporting Pacifica. They are mentioned by name in Project 2025. So
bit south. We're joined now by Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author most recently of a revised and updated edition of her book, Understanding Palestine and Israel. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Great to be with you, Brian.
I want to start in Syria, where we left things with our last guest. During the chaos surrounding the fall of Bashar al-Assad, Israel basically invaded southern Syria, bombed a large portion of Syria's military infrastructure, and more recently has been threatening to fight in defense of Druze minority communities in southern Syria that, according to their public statements, don't seem to want to be defended by Israel. How do you make sense of what the Netanyahu government is doing here?
Well, I think what they're doing is using the year of genocidal assault on Gaza and the degree to which that absorbed the attention appropriately of the international community, of the region, of Palestinians themselves, to expand military occupation and land expropriation from the West Bank, where a major escalation has been underway for months, as well as in Syria and Lebanon. So in Lebanon, we can get to that later, but it was a similar situation with the fighting, 2 months of very intensive fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, that led to, among other things, the reoccupation of much of southern Lebanon. And in Syria, Israel used the opportunity, not only it had been bombing, as it still is, various targets in Syria, claiming that they were all weapons caches of various sorts that were being allegedly sent to Hezbollah by Iran through Syria, and that therefore it was legitimate. Now they're not even bothering to make that claim. They're making clear that the longstanding Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights is not sufficient, and they have, since the overthrow of Assad, occupied more than half of the territory of the UN-patrolled demarcation zone, the buffer zone that was established in 1974 at the end of the 1973 war, which has been monitored and patrolled by the United Nations since that time. Israel simply marched in with its soldiers after, as you say, Brian, having destroyed the entire Syrian Navy and somewhere between 70 and 80% of the strategic military capacity of Syria, of the whole country, on the grounds that Syria didn't really have a new government yet. And in fact, it did. It wasn't a government that Israel was necessarily thrilled with, although that remains to be seen. But it was a good excuse for Netanyahu to make this claim that the occupation of far more land in Syria is necessary and somehow legitimate for Israel's security. More recently, just I think it was Sunday, Netanyahu demanded what he called the complete demilitarization of southern Syria, as if, number one, he had the right to decide that about another sovereign country. It was as if he saw himself as negotiating a ceasefire at the end of a war. and setting the terms for what that ceasefire would look like. And that's after already having occupied, as I mentioned, about half or more of the UN-monitored buffer zone, and claiming that we have to guarantee Israeli security, and that's how we're going to do it. But what they are saying in words, that this is only temporary, doesn't match what they're doing on the ground. What we're seeing on the ground, and there were some interesting interviews with Syrians living in that area, who say that it's already clear that the Israeli military, the IDF, is moving in for long-term or permanent occupation. They are controlling the territory, they are building roads, and they've built actually some buildings in the area. They're preventing farmers from getting to their crops. They have destroyed water pumps, destroyed housing, house demolitions is going on as if this were Gaza, and destroying ancient olive trees as well, and taken Syrian civilians as prisoners, detaining them inside Israel and offering them, this is the extraordinary part, the IDF is apparently offering some of these Syrian civilians access to things like water, which has been in short supply since the Israeli occupation, access to food, access to electrical power, and access potentially to jobs in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, which is a primarily Druze population. So that what they're trying to do is link the Druze community in Syria with the Druze community that has been living under Israeli occupation for the last 55 years, and the Druze inside Israel. There is a Druze community, I think it's about 100, 125,000 people, who are citizens of Israel, who are known for being very loyal. They are among the only Arab community in 48 Israel that serve regularly in the Israeli military. And this is, you know, it's a funny thing. Well, not really funny, but it's an odd coincidence, if you will, perhaps more than that, that Israel has a history that goes back to the creation of the state for building ties with relations, building relations with countries that are not Arab countries in the area, like Iran when it was under the Shah, the US-backed Shah, like Turkey in an earlier iteration, and also building ties or trying to build ties with minority communities who are not Muslims in neighboring Arab countries. So the Druze in Syria, the Christians in Lebanon, the Kurds at various points in Iraq. So this is a long-standing part of Israeli strategy. They used to call it the periphery strategy that had to do both with non-Arab countries nearby and non-Arab populations in the neighboring Arab countries. So you have threats coming now from Netanyahu. He said a couple of days ago, if the regime, talking about the new government in Syria, he says, if the regime harms the Druze, it will be harmed by us, sort of putting themselves, the Israelis forward as being the protectors of the Druze. But as you say, the Druze are not so keen on this. There was an incident a day or two ago where Israeli troops raised their flag, the Israeli flag, in a Syrian, southern Syrian town, a Druze town, thinking it would be welcomed. You know, oh, great, they're here to protect us. Instead, the flag was pulled down and burned by the local Druze community, who don't forget that Israel has been occupying Druze land in Syria, inside Syria, since 1967. And it's their families, their friends, who have been living under that military occupation since that time.
There have been some reports of exchanges of fire between forces loyal to the new Syrian government and people in at least one Druze community. But from what I saw, the public statements coming out of that community's leaders kind of said, this is bad. We're going to find out who's responsible. We absolutely don't want Israel defending us.
Yeah, I know the incident you're talking about. It was in a small town, and it remains. I actually checked on it this morning. There was still no clear information whether it was sort of a personal fight that had gone on between a few people, or whether it actually was some kind of a local Druze community versus an Israeli military assault. It isn't very clear. What is clear is that there's no indication that any significant number, I'm sure there may be some individuals, but there's no indication of any significant support from Druze communities for having Israeli troops occupying their land, from losing their land to those troops, from having their homes or their olive trees destroyed. This is what Israeli occupation looks like. So it's not surprising that those who are in areas newly occupied just in these last 2 months by the Israeli troops, that they are not happy about this. The Israelis can claim all they want, that we're here to protect the Druze. The Druze are saying, we are Syrians. If we have a problem with the new government, we'll deal with it. The new government, on the other hand, has gone out of its way, in words at least so far, to welcome in minority forces, the Druze, Christians. There's a question about the Kurds. This remains an open, complicated question where the relationship is still much more tense, because the Kurds have been and still are, the Kurds in Syria are backed by the United States, interestingly, making it even more complicated. But there's been a level of armed opposition to the earlier regime, the Assad regime, by the forces that are now the new government, who were supported by the Kurds, by, you know, who were opposed by the Kurds. So the Kurds were not part of the anti-Assad mobilizations over the last decade. They stood outside of that, not necessarily embracing the government, but dealing collaboratively, let's say, with the government. So that's a little bit more complicated. But in terms of the Druze, the Christians, and other minorities in Lebanon, the Alawites included, the new regime has made an effort to reassure them that their rights will be respected, that they will be treated like all other Syrians, that it will not be a sectarian regime. I think there are questions that remain. This was a political force that's now the government of Syria that has a history of quite extremist versions of Islamism. And whether that is as put in the past as they claim it is, we'll have to see. But so far, they have said mostly the right things about bringing the minority communities into the government and into safety.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to use our last few minutes to talk about the situation in Gaza, where the first phase of the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel is basically over. Israel seems to be trying to renegotiate the sketched out terms of the second phase in a way that will let them keep occupying parts of Gaza. Israel has cut off aid flows into Gaza, which threatens an imminent humanitarian catastrophe. And it's very hard to get a read on the posture of the Trump administration. There's been some media reports that the Trump administration is negotiating directly with Hamas, which might be a good idea, but would have been considered inconceivable by all previous U.S. administrations. Simultaneously, the Trump administration is getting ready to send more than $3 billion worth of weapons to Israel. Let's start with how to read the Trump administration's moves here. What is their stake?
Well, I wish we could say with any clarity that this is what the Trump administration's strategy is. I think they have been deliberately very opaque. And whether deliberate or not, I think that their strategy has veered all over the place. The Israelis, Netanyahu in particular, has claimed that the proposal being discussed about how to move forward with the expiration of phase one of the ceasefire, it expired last weekend, and the Israeli position was, no, we're not going to move into what was required in the ceasefire, negotiations for how to move into phase two. They've said, instead, we want to just extend phase one, which means you have to give up all the hostages, half of them right now, and the other half after whatever negotiations we deign to participate in. But without any clarity about whether any more Palestinian prisoners would be released, as has been the requirement of the ceasefire. And the Israelis have been claiming that this proposal actually came from Steve Witkoff, the Trump administration's special envoy to these talks. There's no indication of that from Witkoff, from the Trump administration, from the White House, from Trump, from anybody else. But neither are they denying it. So we don't know. This was either an Israeli move that they were counting on Witkoff not saying, hold on there, we never said this. This is not our position. And if that was the case, he called it. He was right. They gave in to what Israel wants, Israel gets, once again. Or maybe it was Witkoff's idea, and for whatever reason, he doesn't want to claim it. So none of this is very clear. What is clear is that negotiations are underway. As you say, it does appear that the U.S. is now negotiating directly with Hamas. There's some indications that those talks have actually been going on for as much as 2 weeks already without much public awareness of it. But what exactly is being negotiated remains very unclear, whether it's the immediate ceasefire. The only statements that have come from the White House are that they are negotiating for the return of four hostages, one of whom is alive, three are dead, and they want the return of bodies. These are four dual citizens, U.S.-American citizens, who are being held in Gaza. As I say, one of them is alive. And what they're negotiating, are they negotiating, for example, the return of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for those hostages, which has been the fundamental basis of the ceasefire agreement that was signed on to in July, in January, which was the great accomplishment being claimed by the Trump administration. There's no indication of that. All we know is that they're demanding the return of the hostages. including threats directly as of yesterday by Trump himself, saying, "You either return those hostages or you're all dead," addressing the people of Gaza in an outrageous example of threat of collective murder of an entire population.
That was so a post on the social media platform he owns, Truth Social.
Yeah, he tends to make most of his statements there, I guess. For those of us who don't read it, we have to wait to hear it in the other press.
Right.
But yes, that's
not bad for your share price. All right, Phyllis, I'm sorry to cut this short.
Yeah, they had to take a pledge drive break. You can help WEFT out sometime soon if you like. There'll be a Power to the Tower campaign. I like that as a working title. We're broadcasting at really low power. It's apparently just the tube. Yeah. Only have a little time for a male voice in here. I was going to try and get International Women's Day recognized with this piece from Arundhati Roy from about 4 or 5 months ago in the UK, where she was accepting an award. She has a long quotes at length. Edward, the playwright Pinter. So it's a little confusing. So I'll try and highlight that again. The award she got is a hyphenated name from Penn UK. That's, I forget what Penn stands for. Anyway, halfway through the hour, so why don't I press a button here and give myself some slack. I think we're ready for this this little underwriting announcement from a small business in town here.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces, .com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Thanks, Rick. Okay, right on to what's a half-hour segment. We're going to hear about 10 minutes of it. Hopefully, we'll get some of the statistics that I played from Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, if you haven't heard of his writings about election suppression. He says it was pivotal in the last campaign. It wasn't just disaffection, of which there was a bunch. More people sat out than either candidate got in the presidential election here in the U.S. of eligible voters.
Palast, Greg Palast, is really a hero of this show. He is the author of How Trump Stole 2020, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters. He is a filmmaker, journalist, the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. We sort of found Greg in another country trying to report about an election taking place in the United States. Greg Palast, it's a long time since we first spoke to you at the BBC. Welcome back.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the welcome, but I wish I didn't have to come back. You know, back in 2000 when I uncovered that tens of thousands of black men were removed from the voter rolls of Florida. You were one of the only people that put me on the air to report that. But I thought once it came out and finally the establishment press picked it up, that that's how Bush won the election, by removing black people. I thought that'd be the end of it. And, you know, we're going to have a Help America Vote Act and all that stuff. But in fact, we are in the worst Jim Crow period since the Voting Rights Act of 65. We are in the worst shape. And if you go to gregpalast.com, you can read my story, which is How Trump and the GOP Fixed 2026. Yes, 2026. This is the year of the Great Purge. So that's what I want to talk about, is because we talked before about how Trump used vote suppression to win the race. You know, if not for Jim Crow vote suppression tactics, and I give my numbers, the numbers I used for the ACLU and NAACP, Black Voters Matter Fund, when I went to federal court, 3,565,000 votes were denied. Mostly people of color, either they were blocked from voting or their ballots were discounted. And we're heading, it's going to get worse as we head forward into 2026. And the big thing that's happening, I know that the Democratic Party and others tend to go to sleep in what they call off years. Well, there's no off years for vote suppressors. So understand how our system works. The number one threat to voters, and voters of color in particular, young people, is the purging of the voter rolls. And that happens in the year before the election under federal law, the system of purging using using computers to mass wipe out voter registrations. This is not about changing ballots, Dennis. This is not about people talk about Musk sending spiders from outer space to change the vote tabulating machine. Take off your tinfoil hats, guys. This is stuff that I get from the government itself, from the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. Under the law, states must purge their voter rolls in the year before the election. Now, some states use that to remove people who are dead. They shouldn't vote. People who have moved out of their jurisdictions, they shouldn't vote in those jurisdictions. That's correct. But we found, I say we, the groups, I'm a statistician by training and economist, we uncovered for the ACLU, went through every single name on the purge list, obviously using computers, using the experts from Amazon and the U.S. Postal Service. I should now call it, now that we privatize, it'll be the U.S. X Service. And we used the experts, and they went through name by name and found out that the lists are 63.3% erroneous. That is, two-thirds of the people on these hit lists who aren't listed as dead should not have been removed. I've talked many times about, like, the people I've met, like Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin, who was, I was there when she was thrown out of the polling station, and because she was purged. So the big purge is this year, 2025. And last year, or the 2023 leading to 2024, 4,776,000 people, sorry, give you numbers, let's call it 5 million, Dennis. 5 million people were wrongly purged off the voter rolls. 5 million. Now, some of them come back. Some of them don't all vote for, wouldn't have all voted for Harris. Some of them wouldn't have voted. But the bottom line is that probably Harris in that pile lost 2 million votes. And, you know, this is, and I'm telling you as a statistician, I give you more exact numbers, doesn't matter. You can go to my article and do some arithmetic yourself. But this, let's put it this way, the trend is not good, Dennis. Because in when I did my first studies, they were removing 300,000 people. The next study, I was 18. Next study, 2020, they were, and this is the state of Georgia alone, they were removing 500,000 people. In 2023, they targeted 875,000 Georgia voters. That's about 1 in 6 Georgia voters, overwhelmingly voters of color. 1 in 6 Georgia voters was crossed off the voter rolls. After all these other purges, there's no illegal voters left. And, you know, or they never were illegal. I've always said, if you find an illegal voter, arrest them. You know, if you rob a bank, they're going to close your bank account, they arrest you. So if you have an illegal voter, arrest them. They can't find these illegal voters. But this is the beginning. So 2025, expect the massive, massive purge of the voter rolls. That would be the first thing we're looking at. And Dennis, I want to throw in, I know I'm kind of filibustering here. You can ask some more questions. But the next thing I'm really worried about, two things. Well, I should say, one is the SAVE Act. And I have been talking to some Democrats and other activists. I'm in Chicago now talking to, I was supposed to meet with the mayor today, but he couldn't make it, but meeting with Jesse Jackson. A lot of people are hoping that we could pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Well, forget about it. Agent Orange is president. They are pushing the GOP to pass something called the SAVE Act. And that is to, that's going to create new national requirements for voting, including a proof of citizenship in order to vote. Now, look, no one but a citizen should vote in an American election. That's fine. That's the law. If a non-citizen votes, you go, you do, and you should go to prison. They never find any. Never.
Greg Palast. I'm going to excerpt it there so I can get my International Women's Day special on, which is the great Arundhati Roy. Under a legal shroud in her home country of India, she was in the UK. Greg Palast does have the article that he mentioned. And this was a pledged rising episode, so I think they actually broke for some pledge wrapping, which, as I mentioned earlier, you can always pledge to WEFT. And fell asleep again, this device. I have to do something about that. Arundhati Roy, I don't think she needs a lot of introduction. She hasn't been on Democracy Now. I was looking for an explicitly International Women's Day episode that had her that I could have run. But I found this, and it's only 22 minutes long, so we get most of it on the air here. She's accepting award, which has Harold Pinter in the name. I think it was given partially to her to raise her level of visibility because of this legal threat she's under, but it's also for all of her great work. And, yeah. It's a very controversial speech, I would say. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, but it's a good provocation, I think.
List of deported or list of people applying for citizenship.
By announcing the name of this year's writer of courage, who I've chosen to share this award with, my greetings to you, Ala Abdel Fattah, writer of courage, and my fellow awardee. We hoped and prayed that you would be released in September, but the Egyptian government decided that you were too beautiful and too dangerous a thinker to be freed yet. But you are here in this room with us. You are the most important person here. From prison, you wrote, I quote, "My words lost any power, and yet they continue to pour out of me. I still had a voice, even if only a handful would listen," unquote. We are listening, Allah, closely. Greetings to you too, my beloved Naomi Klein, friend to both Allah and me. Thank you for being here tonight. It means the world to me. And greetings to all of you gathered here, as well as to those who are invisible perhaps to this wonderful audience, but as visible to me as anybody else in this room. I'm speaking of my friends and comrades in prison in India, lawyers, academics, students, journalists, Umar Khalid, Gulfesha Fatima, Khalid Saifi, Sharjeel Imam, Runa Wilson, Surendra Gadling, Mahesh Raut. I speak to you too, my friend, Khurram Parvez, one of the most remarkable people I know. You've been in prison for 3 years. And you too, Irfan Mehraj, and to the thousands incarcerated in Kashmir and across the country whose lives have been devastated. When Ruth Borthwick, chair of English Pen and of the Pinter panel, first wrote to me about this honor, she said, "The Pen Pinter Prize is awarded to a writer who has sought to define, quote, the real truth of our lives and our societies through unflinching, unswerving, fierce intellectual determination." That's a quote from Harold Pinter's Nobel Prize acceptance speech. The word unflinching made me pause for a moment because I think of myself as someone who's almost permanently flinching. I would like to dwell a little on the theme of flinching and unflinching, which may be best illustrated by Harold Pinter himself. And I quote, "I was present at a meeting at the US Embassy in London in the late 1980s. The United States Congress was about to decide whether to give more money to the Contras in their campaign against the state of Nicaragua. I was a member of a delegation speaking on behalf of Nicaragua, but the most important member of this delegation was a Father John Metcalf. The leader of the US body was Raymond Seitz, then number two to the ambassador, later ambassador himself. Father Metcalf said, 'Sir, I'm in charge of a parish in the north of Nicaragua. My parishioners built a school, a healthcare center, a cultural center. We have lived in peace. A few months ago, a Contra force attacked the parish. They destroyed everything, the school, the health center, the cultural center. They raped nurses and teachers, slaughtered doctors in the most brutal manner. They behaved like savages. Please demand that the US government withdraw its support from this shocking terrorist activity.' Raymond Seitz had a very good reputation as a rational, responsible, and highly sophisticated man. He was greatly respected in diplomatic circles. He listened, paused, and then spoke with some gravity. 'Father,' he said, 'let me tell you something. In war, innocent people always suffer.' There was a frozen silence. We stared at him. He did not flinch," unquote. Remember that President Reagan called the Contras, quote, "the moral equivalent of our founding fathers," a turn of phrase that he was clearly fond of. He also used it to describe the CIA-backed Afghan Mujahideen, who then morphed into the Taliban. And it is the Taliban who rule Afghanistan today, after waging a 20-year-long war against the US invasion and occupation. Before the Contras and the Mujahideen, there was the war in Vietnam and the unflinching US military doctrine that ordered its soldiers to kill anything that moves. If you read the Pentagon Papers and other documents on US war aims in Vietnam, you can enjoy some lively, unflinching discussions about how to commit genocide. Is it better to kill people outright or starve them slowly? Which would look better? The problem that the compassionate Mandarins in the Pentagon faced was that, unlike Americans, who, according to them, want, I quote, "life, happiness, wealth, power," Asians, stoically accept the destruction of wealth and the loss of lives and force America to carry their, quote, strategic logic to its conclusion, which is genocide, unquote. A terrible burden to be borne unflinchingly. And here we are all these years later, more than a year into yet another genocide, the US and Israel's unflinching and ongoing televised genocide in Gaza and now Lebanon in defense of a colonial occupation and an apartheid state. The death toll so far is officially 42,000, a majority of them women and children. This does not include those who died screaming under the rubble of buildings, neighborhoods, whole cities, and whose bodies have not yet been recovered. A recent study by Oxfam says that more children have been killed by Israel in Gaza than in the equivalent period of any other war in the last 20 years. To assuage their collective guilt for their early years of indifference towards one genocide, the Nazi extermination of millions of European Jews, the United States and Europe have prepared the grounds for another. Like every state that has carried out ethnic cleansing and genocide in history, Zionists in Israel, who believe themselves to be the chosen people, began by dehumanizing Palestinians before driving them off their land and murdering them. Prime Minister Menachem Begin called Palestinians two-legged beasts. Yitzhak Rabin called them grasshoppers who could be crushed. And Golda Meir said there was no such thing as Palestinians. Winston Churchill, that famous warrior against fascism, said, "I do not admit that the dog in the manger has the final right to the manger, even though he may have lain there for a very long time," and then went on to declare that a higher race had the final right to the manger. Once those two-legged beasts, grasshoppers, dogs, and non-existent people were murdered, ethnically cleansed and ghettoized, a new country was born. It was celebrated as a land without people for a people without a land. The nuclear-armed state of Israel was to serve as a military outpost and gateway to the natural wealth and resources of the Middle East for Europe and the US, a lovely coincidence of aims and objectives. The new state was supported unhesitatingly and unflinchingly, armed and bankrolled, coddled and applauded, no matter what crimes it committed. It grew up like a protected child in a wealthy home whose parents smile proudly as it commits atrocity upon atrocity. No wonder today it feels free to boast openly about committing genocide. At least the Pentagon Papers were secret. They had to be stolen and leaked. No wonder Israeli soldiers seem to have lost all sense of decency. No wonder they flood the social media with depraved videos of themselves wearing the lingerie of women they have killed or displaced. Videos of themselves mimicking dying Palestinians and wounded children or raped and tortured prisoners. Images of themselves blowing up buildings while they smoke cigarettes or jive to music on their headphones. Who are these people? What can possibly justify what Israel is doing? The answer, according to Israel and its allies, as well as the Western media, is the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th last year, the killing of Israeli citizens and the taking of Israeli hostages. According to them, history only began a year ago. So this is the part in my speech where I am expected to equivocate to protect myself, my neutrality, and my intellectual standing. This is the part where I'm meant to lapse into moral equivalence and condemn Hamas, the other militant groups in Gaza, and their ally Hezbollah in Lebanon for killing citizens, taking people hostage, and to condemn the people of Gaza who celebrated the Hamas attack. Once that's done, it all becomes easy, doesn't it? Ah, well, everyone's terrible. What can one do? Let's go shopping instead. I refuse to play the condemnation game. Let me make myself clear. I do not tell oppressed people how to resist their oppression or who their allies should be. When the US President Joe Biden met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli War Cabinet during a visit to Israel in October 2023, he said, "I don't believe you have to be a Jew to be a Zionist, and I am a Zionist." Unlike President Joe Biden, who calls himself a non-Jewish Zionist and unflinchingly bankrolls and arms Israel while it commits its war crimes, I'm not going to declare myself or define myself in any way that is narrower than my writing. I am what I write. I'm acutely aware that being the writer that I am, the non-Muslim that I am, and the woman that I am, it would be difficult, perhaps impossible, for me to survive very long under the rule of Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Iranian regime. But that is not the point here. The point is to educate ourselves about the history and the circumstances under which they came to exist. The point is that right now they are fighting against an ongoing genocide. The point is to ask ourselves whether a liberal, secular fighting force can go up against a genocidal war machine. Because when all the powers of the world are arrayed against them, who do they have to turn to but God? I'm aware that Hezbollah and the Iranian regime have vocal detractors in their own countries, some who also languish in jails or who have faced far worse outcomes. I'm aware that some of their actions, the killing of civilians and the taking of hostages on October 7th by Hamas, constitute war crimes. However, there cannot be an equivalence between this and what Israel and the United States are doing in Gaza, in the West Bank, and now in Lebanon. The root of all the violence, including the violence of October 7th, is Israel's occupation of Palestinian land and its subjugation of the Palestinian people. History did not begin on October 7th, 2023. I ask you, which of us sitting in this hall would willingly submit to the indignity that Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank have been subjected to for decades? What peaceful means have the Palestinian people not tried? What compromise have they not accepted, other than the one that requires them to crawl on their knees and eat dirt? Israel is not fighting a war of self-defense. It is fighting a war of aggression, a war to occupy more territory, to strengthen its apartheid apparatus, and tighten its control on Palestinian people and the region. Since October 7th, 2023, apart from the tens of thousands of people it has killed, Israel has displaced the majority of Gaza's population many times over. It has bombed hospitals, it has deliberately targeted and killed doctors, aid workers, and journalists. A whole population is being starved. Their history is sought to be erased. All this is supported both morally and materially by the wealthiest, most powerful governments in the world and their media. And here I include my country, India, which supplies Israel with weapons as well as thousands of workers. There is no daylight between these countries and Israel. In the last year alone, the US has spent $17.9 billion in military aid to Israel. So let us once and for all dispense with the lie about the US being a mediator, a restraining influence, or as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, considered to be on the extreme left of mainstream US politics, put it, working ceaselessly tirelessly for a ceasefire. A party to the genocide cannot be a mediator. Not all the power and money, not all the weapons and propaganda on earth can any longer hide the wound that is Palestine, the wound through which the whole world, including Israel, bleeds. Polls show that a majority of the citizens in the countries whose governments enable the Israeli genocide have made it clear that they do not agree with this. We have watched the marches of hundreds of thousands of people, including a young generation of Jews who are tired of being used, tired of being lied to. Who would have imagined that we would live to see the day when German police would arrest Jewish citizens for protesting against Israel and Zionism and accuse them of anti-Semitism? Who would have thought that the US government would, in the service of the Israeli state, undermine its cardinal principle of free speech by banning pro-Palestine slogans? The so-called moral architecture of Western democracies, with a few honorable exceptions, has become a grim laughingstock in the rest of the world. When Benjamin Netanyahu holds up a map of the Middle East in which Palestine has been erased and Israel stretches from the river to the sea, he's applauded as a visionary who's working to realize the dream of a Jewish homeland. But when Palestinians and their supporters chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," they are accused of explicitly calling for the genocide of Jews. Are they really? Or is that a sick imagination projecting its own darkness onto others? An imagination that cannot countenance diversity, cannot countenance the idea of living in a country alongside other people, equally with equal rights, like everybody else in the world does. An imagination that cannot afford to acknowledge that Palestinians want to be free, like South Africa is, like India is, like all countries that have thrown off the yoke of colonialism are, countries that are diverse, deeply, maybe even fatally flawed, but free. When South Africans were chanting their popular rallying cry, "Amandla, power to the people," were they calling for the genocide of white people? They were not. They were calling for the dismantling of the apartheid state, just as Palestinians are. The war that has begun now will be terrible, but it will eventually dismantle Israeli apartheid. The whole world will be far safer for everyone, including for Jewish people, and far more just. It will be like pulling an arrow from our wounded heart. If the US government withdrew its support of Israel, the war could stop today. Hostilities could end right this minute. Israeli hostages could be freed. Palestinian prisoners could be freed. The negotiations with Hamas and the other Palestinian stakeholders that must eventually, inevitably follow the war could instead take place now and prevent the suffering of millions of people. How sad that most people would consider that a naive and laughable proposition. As I conclude, let me turn to your words, Alaa Abd El Fattah, from your book of prison writing called You Have Not Been Defeated. I have rarely read such beautiful words about the meaning of victory and defeat and the political necessity of honestly looking despair in the eye. I've rarely seen writing in which a citizen separates himself from the state, from the generals, and even from the slogans of the square with such bell-like clarity. And I quote, "The center is treason because there's room in it only for the general. The center is treason, and I have never been a traitor. They think they've pushed us back into the margins. They don't realize that we never left it. We just got lost for a brief while. Neither the ballot boxes, nor the palaces, or the ministries, or the prisons, or even the graves are big enough for our dreams. We never sought the center because it has no room except for those who abandoned the dream. Even the square was not big enough for us, so most of the battles of the revolution happened outside it, and most of the heroes remained outside the frame." End quote. As the horror we are witnessing in Gaza and now Lebanon quickly escalates into a regional war, its real heroes remain outside the frame, but they fight on because they know that one day, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It will. Keep your eye on your calendar, not on your clock, because that's how the people, not the generals, but the people fighting for their liberation measure time. Thank you.
Brilliant essay, in my opinion. That's Arundhati Roy. She was accepting an award in the UK from Penn, UK Penn. I didn't look up what Penn stands for. It's a writer's group. And she used the occasion to do what she did there, including reading from Harold Pinter when he was fighting against the Contra funding here in the U.S. 25 years ago. A brilliant stroke, I thought. And yeah, I didn't need to have that sped up as much as I did. Opinions you hear are, of course, those of you speaker. We got a jazz collective working on the collection here tight now. That's a little redundant. So if you're interested in the jazz being played down here at WEFT, maybe you could stop in if you're running errands or something. Radio Free Labor, though, is at hand. I haven't pitched them yet. They've got a bang-up show because we've had a bang-up week. My head is banging around in my skull, or my brain is. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. You'll be hearing about the Power to the Tower campaign. We had some technicians. Perhaps Bob can tell you about that. Maybe not on the air, since he was out there a bit when the technicians from Chicago were down trying to diagnose. Good people. Good to hear it. We need to be in good hands because there's a lot of work to be done to rectify the signal. You can always check out the new app and listen to us with studio quality sound. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. Here's a little underwriting announcement from a local business that helps us out with some printing now and again. And yeah, enjoy the bright Saturday light.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.